listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome. Such a thrill to be here at Viviana. I'm thrilled to see you here tonight and to have the great honor of introducing Joan Didion. Of course, tonight is part of Aloud, presented by the Library Foundation, but it's also part of Pacific Standard Time, which, as you know, is organized by the Getty and is a regional celebration, an examination of Los Angeles art, 1945 to 1985. And my colleague, David L. Ulan, who will be conversing with Joan tonight, the book critic for the LA Times, a great friend of libraries, a great friend of books. Together, we've curated a little series of kind of inside aloud programs that relate to Pacific Standard Time, and Joan Didion is our very first program of that series. I'm sure we all have our favorite Joan Didion book. She speaks so much, so deeply to so many of us. Her voice is really the voice we think of, I think, when we think about the 60s, especially in Los Angeles. Someone had asked me why Joan Didion for Pacific Standard Time, and well, she never tuned out. She kept her lens, her steady gaze on the American counterculture, on politics, on the Black Panthers, on rock and roll. She told us about ourselves and our culture. I think she's been called the canary in the American coal mine. She was prescient, she's a soothsayer. And we're very, very delighted to have her here tonight. I think this cathedral is exactly the right place to hear Joan Didion, because her voice has that clarion quality, like a bell in this beautiful campanile up here. And in Blue Nights, Joan Didion enumerates memories of her family life here in Southern California, in Hollywood and Brentwood and Malibu, and she actually laments. She says, how inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here. So I know we will take away our memories from this wonderful night, but please appreciate this moment. Please welcome Joan Didion and David L. Ulan. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Louise. Thank you, Joan. It's a privilege to be up here on a stage with the writer who's meant everything to me. So we're gonna talk for about an hour or so, then we'll turn it over to questions, some questions from you guys. Since we now live in the age of social media, we have some some Facebook questions, which I'll get to. But I wanna start by asking Joan to read a little. We're gonna intersperse a couple of readings in the conversation, and so we're gonna start with the opening pages of the White Album, Joan Didion.
We tell ourselves stories in order to live. The princess is caged in the consulate. The man with the candy will lead the children into the sea. The naked woman on the ledge outside the window on the 16th floor is a victim of acidity, or the naked woman is an exhibitionist, and it would be, quote, interesting, unquote, to know which. We tell ourselves that it makes some difference whether the naked woman is about to commit a mortal sin, or is about to register a political protest, or is about to be the Aristophanic view, snatched back to the human condition by the fireman in priest clothing just visible in the window behind her, the one smiling at the telephoto lens. We look for the sermon in the suicide, for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely, especially if we are writers, by the imposition of a narrative line on the disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria, which is our actual experience. Or at least we do for a while. I'm talking here about a time when I began to doubt the premises of all the stories I had told myself, a common condition, but one I found troubling. I suppose this period began around 1966 and continued until 1971. During those 10 years, I appeared on the face of it, a competent enough member of some community or another, a signer of contracts and air travel cards, a citizen. I wrote a couple of times a month for one magazine or another, published two books, worked on several motion pictures, participated in the paranoia of the time, in the raising of a small child, and in the entertainment of large numbers of people passing through my house. Made gingham curtains for spare bedrooms, remembered to ask agents if any reduction of points would be pari passu with the financing studio. Put lentils to soak on Saturday night for lentil soup on Sunday. Made quarterly FICA payments and renewed my driver's license on time. Missing on the written exam only the question about the financial responsibility of California drivers. It was a time of my life when I was frequently named. I was named godmother to children. I was named lecturer and panelist, colloquist and conferee. I was even named in 1968 a Los Angeles Times Woman of the Year, along with Mrs. Ronald Reagan, the Olympic swimmer Debbie Meyer, and 10 other California women who seemed to keep in touch and do good works. I did no good works, but I tried to keep in touch. I was responsible. I recognized my name when I saw it. Quite often, I even answered letters addressed to me, not exactly on receipt, but eventually, particularly if the letters had come from strangers. During my absence from the country these past 18 months, such replies would begin. This was an adequate enough performance as improvisations go. The only problem was that my entire education, everything I had been told or had told myself, insisted that the production was never meant to be improvised. I was supposed to have a script and had mislaid it. I was supposed to hear cues and no longer did. I was meant to know the plot, but all I knew was what I saw, flash pictures in variable sequence, images with no meaning beyond their temporary arrangement, not a movie but a cutting room experience. In what would probably be the middle of my life, I wanted still to believe in the narrative and in the narrative's intelligibility, but to know that one could change the sense with every cut was to begin to perceive the experience as rather more electrical than ethical. During this period, I spent what were for me the usual proportions of time in Los Angeles and New York and Sacramento. I spent what seemed to many people I knew an eccentric amount of time in Honolulu, the particular aspect of which lent me the illusion that I could at any minute order from room service a revisionist theory of my own history, garnished with a Vanda orchid. I watched Robert Kennedy's funeral on a veranda at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Honolulu, and also the first reports from Milei. I reread all of George Orwell on the Royal Hawaiian Beach. And I also read in the papers that came one day late from the mainland the story of Betty Lansdowne Fouquet, a 26-year-old woman with faded blonde hair who put her 5-year-old daughter out on the center divider of Interstate 5, some miles south of the last Bakersfield exit. The child whose fingers had to be pried loose from the cyclone fence when she was rescued 12 hours later by the California Highway Patrol reported that she had run after the car carrying her mother and stepfather and brother and sister, quote, for a long time, unquote. Certain of these images did not fit into any narrative I knew.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you about that passage because it seems to address a number of issues that come up a lot in your writing, both then and now, this issue of improvisation, this issue of narrative breakdown, or the loss of a defining narrative. This has been a factor, as you say, from the mid-60s in your work, from going back to Slouching Towards Bethlehem to Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream. At what point, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how that sense of broken narrative began to assert itself and how you began to have to think about that as a factor in your writing.
It began to assert itself during that very period. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on that really did not lend itself to, as I said, any narrative I knew. So I kept trying to find a new narrative and couldn't. And finally, I kind of learned to live without a narrative, you know, which is the coward's way out.
Well, or it could be the brave person's way in some way, because I think that notion you talk about in later about narrative being sentimental in some way is something we tend to cling to. We need narrative, but in the end, as you say, you know, we tell ourselves stories in order to live what we do for a while. At a certain point, those narratives end up deserting us.
Right.
And I think that, I also wanted to start with that because it draws a through line from your earlier work to the new book, to Blue Nights, which is also, I think, in some ways a book about a moment when narrative becomes atomized. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how the new book deals with that question. You say it's a book about your daughter's death, and that's not the narrative we're supposed to hear. You know, the narrative we're supposed to hear is not the narrative in which the child predeceases the parent.
No.
So in terms of approaching that material, I'm curious about how your sense of that.
This was a very difficult book for me to write, actually, because it has no narrative. I didn't find the narrative. I simply decided to go without a narrative, and so it was a little tricky for me to write it.
Well, it operates as a collection of fragments in some way.
It's all fragments.
Right.
Yeah.
You wrote it over a period of 6-8 months?
I wrote it over a period of six months, yeah.
Okay. And how did that fragmentary structure evolve? Did you simply start writing it in kind of fragmentary chunks, or did it at a certain point it became clear to you that was going to be the way through the material?
I started writing it because I thought it was going to be about children in a much, much more researched way. Then it became clear to me gradually that it wasn't about children. It was about my own child. It was about my own experience with having children. And then I kind of hit a dead spot where I couldn't see what I was doing. And then the idea of calling it Blue Nights occurred to me, and that kind of pushed it through.
You want to, for those who haven't read it, do you want to sort of explain the Blue Nights metaphor?
Blue Nights are those nights around the summer solstice when everything turns blue. Well, it doesn't happen in California because in Southern California, the sun just drops. I watched it this afternoon. Just drops into the horizon, But it does happen in New York. It happens dramatically in Europe, but it happens pretty dramatically in New York too. It's far enough south, or far enough whatever you have to be to get the Blue Knights. And the Blue Knights came to represent for me at some point. They came to represent death, the approach of death, the end of the brightness, the coming of the dark, the coming of darkness, which of course is only, of course is our ways of thinking of death. So when I realized that I could call it Blue Knights, I knew that it was going to have to do with death. It was going to have to do with getting older, and that was a kind of interesting thing to me because it was novel to me because nobody had told me I was ever going to get older, you know. So thinking about that kind of kept me going through the period when I was going to abandon the book.
You talk in the book about that, about both your own sense of getting older or your, there's a part where a doctor says to you, you're not adjusting well to the idea of getting older, and you say, adjusting well, I'm not adjusting at all.
Yeah, right. It's as people keep, somebody always says to me, it's not for sissies. No, the idea of getting older was always something that was going to happen to other people, as I saw it.
So in that sense, I mean, you write about this. I want to talk to you about, you know, this is, I think, the first book of yours that where you really pull out and address the reader directly.
Well, you have to address the reader directly if you're going to tell the reader your deepest secrets. I mean, if I'm going to sit here and tell you how old I am, that's a pretty deep secret, you know. I mean, until I just blew it by writing it down in a book, you know.
But you also want to talk about the difficulty of writing the book. The book in many ways is about both your own process of aging and also your process of dealing with Quintana's death.
Right. They turned out they were the same thing.
Can you talk about how they were the same thing, what that means to you?
They were the same thing because, like aging, Quintana's death wasn't supposed to happen.
It's a disruption of the narrative.
It's a disruption of the narrative.
But you talk also, it's interesting because Quintana is almost a kind of absence at the center of the book. I mean, you write a lot about her but it's really about her absence. And you talk at one point in the book about the difficulty you're having in actually writing about her or addressing
her.
Well,
I had difficulty on a couple of levels. One was when you're writing about a real person, you have to work yourself into a feeling that you can, that you have the right to write about that person. And that's a very hard right to justify. And so I had to kind of fight my way past that because I had thought, I specifically did not talk about Quintana in the last book I wrote about her, the book I wrote about John's death. I didn't talk about Quintana because it wasn't her book, was my feeling. She could tell her own story. But suddenly it came to me that I did have to tell her story and and I kind of plunged into it.
You talked at one point about permission, about the question of permission in terms of telling that story.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of aspects of Quintana's life. For example, she was adopted. And there were, that got into, did I have the right to tell her story from her point of view, and did I have the right, further, did I have the right to tell her story from the point of view of her other parents, who I didn't know and had never met. That was a quite thorny question that I spent about 6 months trying to get used to, and finally, like everything else in life, you just plunge ahead and do it willy-nilly.
And just see how it works out.
Right.
Now, both this book and Year of Magical Thinking, and in a lot of ways, I think also Where I Was From, are...
Where I Was From was the first of those three books.
Right. They function kind of as a set. They're the books where you shift your focus in some way from you looking out and telling other people's stories to you looking inward more and telling your own stories. I'm curious about that shift. At what point, when you first started working on Where I Was From, how did you decide to make that move from say, being the reporter's position to the memoirist position?
Well, it wasn't so much a memoir. I mean, that isn't really a memoir, and neither is it. I don't think of these books as memoir, of the two later books, The Magical Thinking and Blue Nights. I don't think of them as memoirs. It says memoir on the Library of Congress card, I think, but I argued about this with Knopf, actually.
So what? How do you? What was the substance of that argument?
I mean, I kept saying, I don't like the word memoir, it's soft.
Too touchy-feely.
It's too touchy-feely, yeah.
What did you want to, I mean, I always found it sort of ridiculous that nonfiction books have to have that signifier at all.
We call it nonfiction, which is how I thought of it. And what I wanted to do in, what I had wanted to do in Where I Was From, is I wanted to write a book about California, and but the only way I could come at California was by simply plunging in and telling a lot of stories I knew about California, and in some cases retelling and trying to find the narrative by trying to find the lies.
I'm sorry, the lies or the lines?
Lies.
Okay.
The untruths.
Yes.
All the untruths that I had ever told myself about, or that anybody had ever told me about California, beginning with my parents, I mean, and continuing right through the whole package. I think we all, if we grow up in California, get told a lot of untrue things. And so I decided to start writing those down. Then I realized that I had told as many untrue things about California as anybody else. So I started then, I realized that it was a really exciting realization when I realized I could take my first novel and tear it apart, because it was full of lies. And so that, I think what I got in, the reason I got into that was it was kind of a new way of writing for me. It was not straight looking for the narrative, which I'd spent my entire adult life doing. It was tearing apart the narrative I had found. It was a different approach.
But related, right, in some way, because at the heart of all of it is this sense of the false narrative, right?
Yeah,
you know, breaking apart the false narrative.
Yeah.
Is it different, though? You know, one of the lines of yours that I've used repeatedly in classes and everywhere is the notion of writers always selling someone out, or the notion of that your presence as a reporter in their living room is counter to their best interests. Would you say that your presence in your own living room, in a certain sense, is counter to your own best interests?
Sure it is. I mean, because it forces me right up against the point where I've torn apart, where I've pushed myself now is I've torn apart the only narrative I knew. So I'm always having to start with a blank piece of, a blank mind. Yes, it is counter to my own best interests.
Okay. But the writer wins and does it anyway.
The writer has to do it anyway.
Right. Yeah. And the same question, because one of the questions I've been asked, I mean, I can't answer it because it's not my book, but I've been asked about this book when I've talked to it with people is, was there ever a moment where you would have thought about writing a book like this and not sharing it, writing it for yourself? Is there a sense of, of being a public writer versus a private writer?
I have a lot of people ask me that about magical thinking. Mm-hmm. There was no moment when I have never written anything that wasn't for a reader.
Right.
I cannot imagine writing not for a reader. I mean, some sense of that came through, of why that might be, came through to me when I was watching the rehearsals of Year of Magical Thinking was made into a play. I say it was made into a play. I made it into a play. But there was a point when I was watching the rehearsals when I realized for the first time that a play was a collaboration between the audience and the people who were on the stage, and that it came out of a very active collaboration and it changed every night. And that was a kind of fascinating thing, which is also true of, which is equally true of writing. Everything you write is a collaboration with the reader.
So you don't keep a diary or a journal or any of that?
No, I don't. I've never kept a diary.
I want to touch a little bit more on this, and then I want to shift into broader kind of questions. I think the first time I read the book, I think I overlooked the aspect of it, or minimized the aspect of it, which is you wrestling with what you perceive, I think, as your own failings or regrets. Maybe regrets isn't the right word, about parenting. Mm-hmm. You have a great line that you say something, you say essentially, in fact, I'll read it. One second while I find it. You say, I do not know many people who think they have succeeded as parents. This certainly speaks to my sense of my own parenting experience and to the experience of most of the people I know who have kids. And that seems to be, the more I think about the book, the more that line seems to be important in terms of, the way the story that you're trying to tell.
That was very much the story I was trying to tell when I started the book. Then I realized gradually, I kind of realized that wasn't the book I was writing. That wasn't the story I was telling.
What was the story you were telling?
The story I was telling had to do with the Blue Nights, with death, the approach of some final moment.
You talk in the book also about losing your own creative power or your own literary powers, about the idea that, your sentences become shorter and more compact. At a certain point, there's a line where you say, I'm telling you this true story to prove that I still can.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about that, too, as a sort of element. On reading it, the language seems very, you know, focused and forceful. The language, I mean, maybe more stripped down and spare than some of the other books,
I think it's much more stripped down.
Yeah.
Well, I felt it very strongly that this was a different style. But on the other hand, maybe I felt it before, maybe I've thought it before too. Who knows?
You wrote Year of Magical Thinking in, I think, 88 days, is that?
Yeah, I wrote it in a very short time because I didn't start it until John died on December 30th, 2003. And Quintana got sick where she was already sick, but she got sicker during the next 4 or 5 months. And so I didn't start writing a book at that moment. And I didn't start until the fall, and I finished it in the fall. So yeah, it was a very short time.
And in that book, I had the sense reading it that you were really writing it as a way of maintaining your sanity.
I was writing it as a way, yes, I had lost my sanity. I mean, I was totally crazy. And I think a lot of people who go through grief experiences are totally crazy, and nobody acknowledges that they're crazy, but they secretly know it. So
this book, though, obviously because it was written after the fact, shorter book over a longer span, there's for its immediacy, it's also got a bit more distance.
Oh, it's distant. Yeah.
And so I'm curious about if you can talk a little bit about the difference in that process. Both of them are dealing with, you know, tragic circumstances, but one right in the white hot center of the moment, and one with 4 years, 5 years of perspective.
Yeah, and I don't know, other than Magical Thinking was very, it was fast to write, not only because I was determined to write it fast, and because I was determined to finish it within the year of John's death, and not much was left of that year. So that was one reason that it was fast. But the other reason was because it just seemed to tell itself. This book didn't tell itself. I had to wrestle it out, and it was well. In retrospect, it was kind of exhilarating to keep finding that it was about new things to me.
Things you didn't know that it was about.
Things I didn't know. It was a discovery process.
You say here, and this may tie in with the whole notion of it not being a memoir, you say memories are what you no longer want to remember. The book is a memory book in many ways. It's a litany of memories, and you kind of going back over the memories. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that idea of memories being what you don't want to remember, and how that plays into what, you know, your process through this material.
Well, memories are what you don't want to remember because they hurt very often. I mean, clearly. Memories are, on the other hand, what you have to remember also because they hurt. Memories are stunningly tricky that way. I mean, nothing you think you will never forget, things you think you'll never forget, you have forgotten before you could say them. It's a kind of scary process, what we remember and what we don't.
And how we remember, right? Because they're seductive. In some ways, it makes me think about what you're saying, what you were just saying about California. Memories kind of can reshape themselves. One of the things that's interesting about this book is watching you try and parse those memories and not allow them to become sentimentalized in a certain
right.
way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And not without killing them.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if at this point would you mind reading a small piece from Blue Nights?
I would like to.
I have such a small piece right here.
It has wonderfully big type too. There was a period, a long period, dating from my childhood until quite recently, when I thought I did. A period during which I believed that I could keep people fully present, keep them with me, by preserving their mementos, their things, their totems. The detritus of this misplaced belief now fills the drawers and closets of my apartment in New York. There is no drawer I can open without seeing something I do not want on reflection to see. There is no closet I can open with room left for the clothes I might actually want to wear. In one closet that might otherwise be put to such use, I see instead three old Burberry raincoats of John's, a suede jacket given to Quintana by the mother of her first boyfriend, and an angora cape long since moth-eaten, given to my mother by my father not long after World War II. In another closet, I find a chest of drawers and perilously stacked assortment of boxes. I open one of the boxes. I find photographs taken by my grandfather when he was a mining engineer in the Sierra Nevada in the early years of the 20th century. In another of the boxes, I find scraps of lace and embroidery that my mother had salvaged from her own mother's boxes of mementos. The jet beads, the ivory rosaries, the objects for which there is no satisfactory solution. In the third of the boxes, I find skein after skein of needlepoint yarn, saved in the eventuality that remedial stitches might even now be required on a canvas completed and given away in 2001. In the chest of drawers, I find papers written by Quintana when she was still at the Westlake School for Girls, the research study on stress, the analysis of Angel Clare's role in Tess of the D'Urbervilles. I find her Westlake summer uniforms. I find her navy blue gym shorts. I find the blue and white pinafore she wore for volunteering at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. I find the black wool chalet dress I bought her when she was 4 at Bendel's on West 57th Street. When I bought that black chalet dress, Bendel's was still on West 57th Street. It was that long ago. Bendel's became, after Geraldine Sutt stopped running it, just another store. But when it was on West 57th Street and I bought that dress, it was special. It was everything I wanted either one of us to wear. It was all Holly's harp, chiffon, and lettuce edges in sizes 1 and 2. Other objects for which there is no satisfactory resolution. I continue opening boxes. I find more faded and cracked photographs than I ever again want to see. I find many engraved invitations to the weddings of people who are no longer married. I find mass cards from the funerals of people whose faces I no longer remember. In theory, these mementos serve to bring back the moment. In fact, they only serve to make clear how inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here. How inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here is something else that I could never afford to see.
I want to ask you,
thank you.
I want to ask you about this process, both in Blue Nights and also in a lot of the other work, about here you're operating both as a kind of observer and the observed, like we were talking about. In work, say, like Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream or Slouching Towards Bethlehem, you were really in the piece as the observer, whether overtly or covertly. You're always allowing us to see both what you're looking at and in some way you as you're
working.
As you're looking at it. And
yeah.
I want to talk to you about that ask you about that.
It's kind of important to me. It has been, I thought it was important always for the reader for me to place myself in the piece so that the reader knew where I was. The reader knew who was talking. And so I was always putting myself rather more front and center than was approved practice. I mean, it was, at the time I started doing these pieces, it was not considered a good thing for writers to put themselves front and center. But I had this strong feeling that you had to place yourself there and show exactly who was, tell the reader exactly who that was at the other end of the voice.
How did you develop that idea? Because as you say, when you first started doing it, there were other writers who were also kind of developing, let's say, sympathetic approaches at the same time, you know, the so-called new journalists. But how did you begin to develop that idea, and how did you sell that in the early days to, say, to a magazine like the Saturday Evening Post, which must have been resistant?
Well, you could sell anything to the Saturday Evening Post. I mean, frankly, they were going broke. They would try anything.
They're their precursor for the print culture of today.
Yes.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but as a writer, how did you begin to develop that as a strategy?
It just always seemed essential to me that the reader know where I was. I have no idea how it became so important, but it did.
In some of those early pieces that, and I want to double back too to what we were talking about in terms of where I was from, in some of those early pieces, that sense of your own perspective became a kind of mechanism by which people either constructed for themselves or thought you were constructing a kind of mythology of California. I think about, say, the opening of Some Dreamers, where you go through that long riff about this is the California where,
right.
This is the California where you can dial a prayer, but you can't
buy an
book.
Right. Yeah.
There's a, you know, it clearly is coming from your personal perspective, but it seemed to take on this kind of larger social vision.
I and the Saturday Evening Post almost got sued for that piece because it turned out that all of the stuff, when they did the depositions, that all of the stuff that the Chamber of Commerce of San Bernardino wanted to sue me over, all of that stuff came out of Chamber of Commerce literature.
Was it, but you know, I mean, that's an interesting piece because it's ostensibly a magazine piece about a murder trial.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, but it's kind of a it's nothing more than a magazine piece about a murder trial, but it was kind of fun to write. I mean, actually, it was. I remember John and I went out to check it, John went with me to San Bernardino to check it, and so we
to check it in what sense?
Before it was published, I had to check the quotes in the
right.
trial, and I had to go over to San Bernardino and spend a day in the lawyer's office in the lawyer who had defended Lucille Miller. But the reason I had to go over to San Bernardino was to check the quotes in the trial transcript, you know, against his transcript. But anyway, we went over and spent the day in San Bernardino, and then on the way back, went to Dodger Stadium, just stopped and went to Dodger Stadium and watched the Twilighter, and it was really fun. I can't tell you why I brought that up, but it's a nice, as opposed to bad memories or memories that make you unhappy, it's a nice memory.
But it's also, I mean, it's interesting because I think in that piece, it is a magazine piece about a murder trial, but on the other hand, it becomes, or seems to want to become, something bigger, where it becomes about two Californias. You know, you have the sort of coastal California that everybody thinks of, and you have this more hardscrabble inland California.
Right, the California nobody knew.
Right, and those kinds of pieces, I mean, you know, obviously you're very identified with kind of a certain vision of California, a certain sense of how post-war California works. I'm curious about your thoughts on that. I mean, I know what my thoughts are, what people who've read or written about your work think about it, but in terms of that kind of framing of California, was that ever something you were thinking about consciously, or is that simply where the stories were?
No, I was thinking about it consciously. I was thinking about it, and thinking about it erroneously. I saw when I realized when I was doing where I was from that I had misunderstood a lot of that stuff.
What do you want to talk more specifically about? What kinds of things you had misunderstood?
I had misunderstood, for example, I hadn't realized the extent to which there had never been a California the California of my imagination had never really existed.
And that's the old sort of the Oregon Trail California.
The Oregon Trail California that I was brought that I came from. I thought, well, I did come from it, but it didn't mean the same thing I thought it. It didn't mean what I had thought it meant.
What had you thought it meant, and what did you come to think it meant?
I thought the Oregon Trail California was a better way of life. I thought that it was somehow a nobler way of life. I hadn't realized the extent to which the same, that it was permeated with untruths. I didn't realize it really until not long before I did that book about California.
So in some ways, again, it's another kind of collapse of the narrative.
It was a total collapse of a narrative. There was this, something I wrote about in that book that has stuck in my mind still as a symbol of my misunderstanding of everything. We had a family graveyard outside Sacramento, and I used to go out there and look at the graves, and they were all names familiar to me, but obviously nobody I knew, because they were all dead, and they had been dead since before I was born. But at some point, this family graveyard started to be vandalized, and the vandalization got reported in the paper, and a group of neighbors got together and cleaned it up, and my mother reported this to me, and I said, well, didn't somebody in the family do that? And she said, no, nobody. And I mean, so-and-so did it. And I said, but I thought he owned it. She said, oh, well, I guess he sold it. It was a selling of one's what one thought of, or what I like had preferred to think of as heritage, right? And it was, I saw that it was not too different from the Southern Pacific. It was not too different from a whole lot of California stories.
Is that why you called the book "Where I Was From"? But the past tense thing, is that because you're putting away that story?
Yes.
In a certain sense?
Yes.
And how does this come out? I mean, this is also something that I think comes out in some of the fiction, the early fiction, certainly. I mean, Run River, which you take apart in Where I Was From, which is a novel that takes place in Sacramento, and Play As It Lays, which is, in as much as anything, an L.A. novel, and you know, I think of sort of Maria driving those freeways as a sort of metaphor for the disconnection of the city. Is there a relationship when you were writing fiction dealing with California and then also writing nonfiction dealing with California? Is there a relationship between those things? Were you doing certain things in one and certain things in the other?
No, there's the same person. It's the same person is writing one thing one day and one thing with the other hand, you know. Doesn't seem to. I never could separate stuff.
Was it easier to get at certain things in
fiction?
In fiction,
it was easier to get at certain things in nonfiction. I discovered later.
Can you elaborate on that?
How much easier it is to get at certain things in nonfiction?
Yeah.
Well, you can do anything in nonfiction. You can't do it. You can only do one thing in fiction. You can do. One thing to different degrees of success, and so when you're writing fiction, you just try to make it work better and make it more successful. But essentially, you're always doing it's always the same thing that you're doing. Nonfiction, you can really just talk about plunging in. You just plunge in, and you can go anywhere.
You mean, so because of the narrative requirements of fiction, as opposed to...
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't think... I mean, although Play It As It Lays is written in a lot of short chapters and has that same kind of jangly, fragmentary energy in a certain sense of some of the essays, but you feel the overriding pull of the story is something that you can't get away from in the same way that you can in nonfiction?
You can't... I couldn't get away from it in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... I didn't even get away from it. My last novel was what I think of as my Iran-Contra novel. It was a book based on the actual facts of the Iran-Contra case. I mean, it was based on, if it had a single image, it was the Hassanfuss plane falling out of the sky in Central America, which the falling of the Hassanfuss plane, Hassanfuss was the pilot. The falling of that plane was what opened up Iran-Contra, what exposed Iran-Contra finally. But even in that book, which got it as close to being nonfiction fiction as you could get, I guess, or as I could get. Even in that book, it seemed to me that I would be a lot better off if I could just move it into nonfiction. I'd have more room.
That novel came out in 1996. Is that why you haven't
written another novel?
More fiction?
Yeah, I did not want to write another novel after that.
And no, I mean, I know you talked at one point about having taken notes for a novel.
I still have those notes. They're still in a box. But I actually am going to look at them in the next, as soon as things quiet down after Christmas. And going to see if there's anything in them.
Now, I think the other thing I just want to touch on quickly, we're getting close on time, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about, for a lot of readers, myself included, one of the things your nonfiction did was to sort of undercut a certain myth of the 60s in California. I mean, if you think about it, a piece like Slouching Towards Bethlehem, which really is a on-the-ground report from Haight-Ashbury in the Summer of Love, a devastating report. It completely undercuts whatever the sort of flower child myth that was being sold in the media. I think of also in terms of sort of the Edenic qualities of Los Angeles, LA as sort of the sun and surf capital of the universe, in pieces that deal with sort of, you know, fire season and fires and floods. And Los Angeles Notebook, you talk about LA's most abiding image of itself as of the city on fire. I wanted to ask you about the importance of the 60s, or of writing out of the 60s in a certain way. And trying to be a clear-eyed social observer in a time that was so hyped on itself in a certain sense.
Yeah, you had to keep writing in the 60s because people were telling so many wrong stories. You could hardly keep up with them. I mean, it was kind of staggering.
I mean, I wonder, I feel like, in some ways, I feel that that's, you know, we're in a similar moment.
I think we are in a similar moment. I mean, I wonder about a lot of what's going on in public life, where, you know, I wonder where it's going.
Right. I mean, it's...
And I don't have really hopeful thoughts about it.
No, I don't either. I mean, I was. It's interesting because as I was, you know, preparing this interview and reading work, I came upon this line from the end of On the Morning After the 60s, which is published in the White Album. This is a piece that was published in 1970 originally. And I'm just going to read the last sentence, which is, "If I could believe that going to a barricade would affect man's fate in the slightest, I would go to that barricade, and quite often I wish that I could, but it would be less than honest to say that I expect to happen upon such a happy ending." So, given what's happened to the barricades in the last 24 hours, that I think that's I don't want to call it prescient, because it struck me 3 weeks ago when I sort of came across it again. But it does feel like we're in that kind of moment.
That moment. Yeah. And where it will take us is hard to know.
Right. And also, I mean, I guess that sense of California as a kind of dangerous landscape. You know, you say in the new book that California is dangerous, not necessarily fatal, but dangerous. And you talk about the notion of, when you lived in Malibu, that the signs were when the fire comes, not if the fire comes, that we know these things are coming, that there is something lurking out there, however smooth or placid our surface might be, that's going to come up and that's coming for us at some point. How influential was that idea for you
because I grew up here, so did most of us, but because I grew up here, I was very focused in on the imminence of natural disasters, of fires, of earthquakes. They were always right out there. I could touch them.
Right.
So I don't think you can grow up in California and not have a strong sense that the apocalyptic moment is upon us.
I totally agree. As someone who didn't grow up in California, but who moved here, but that is kind of, you know, talk about hearing the wrong. Not that that's not the wrong story, but that does stand in opposition to this other story that we're constantly hearing about California.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder if, just on that score, I can impose upon you to read one last small piece, if I can find it, which is from the end of your essay, Fire Season, which is just the last bit, which I think touches on this fairly directly.
People who live with fires think a great deal about what will happen when, as the phrase goes in the instruction leaflets, when, quote, the fire comes. These leaflets, which are stuck up on refrigerators all over Los Angeles County, never say if. When the fire comes, there will be no water pressure. The roof, when watered all night, will go dry in seconds. Plastic trash cans must be filled with water and wet gunny sacks kept at hand for smothering the sparks that will blow ahead of the fire. The garden hoses must be connected and left where they can be seen. The cars must be placed in the garage, headed out. Whatever one wants most to save must be placed in the cars. The lights must be left on so that the house can be seen in the smoke. I remember my daughter's Malibu kindergarten sending home on the first day of the fall semester detailed contingency plans with alternative sites where, depending on the direction of the wind when the fire comes, the children will be taken to wait for their parents. The last ditch site was the Naval Air Station at Point Magoo, 20 miles up the coast. Dry winds and dust, hair full of smoke knots, our Malibu child wrote when asked in the fourth grade for an autumn poem. This is very small. Gardens are dead, animals not fed, people mumble as leaves tumble and ashes. Something. The rhythm here is not one that many people outside Los Angeles seem to hear. In the New York Times this morning, I read a piece in which the way people persist in living with fire in Los Angeles was described as denial. Denial is a word from a different lyric altogether. I can't make this out at all. I can't read that last, but you read that last paragraph.
And then we'll turn it over to questions for you. The last sentence is, this will have been only the second fire season over 25 years during which I did not have a house somewhere in Los Angeles County, and the second during which I did not keep the snapshots in a box near the door, ready to go when the fire comes.
Right.
Right. Okay, so last question, and then we'll turn it over. So in some ways, it seems to me that a lot of your work is about this question of how do we live in the shadow of that kind of, whether, you know, emotional or physical sort of...
Which is actually, I mean, it's the great question of all religions, right? How do you live with certain annihilation?
Right. How do you live?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well...
Well, on that note... Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to turn it over to you guys for questions. There are people circulating with microphones. Oh, wait, there are not people circulating with microphones. There are microphones. So come up, one there, one there. We're probably only going to have time for, what, like five or six? Probably three or four. But come up, and we'll take what we can. Here we go.
Hi. So my question is sort of general, but I guess it's why you think that people have this belief that there is a narrative, why we believe that we deserve a narrative. And if there's so much evidence to the contrary that, you know, tragedy is going to strike and the religions deal with how we're going to move forward, how that relates to our construct of a narrative.
Well, why we believe we deserve a narrative is another question altogether. I think we have to we believe, we have to believe. We tell ourselves it's the answer to that question is we tell ourselves stories in order to live. That's.
Hello. I live about a stone's throw from Bella Vista Drive, where Lucille Miller's house was. I think about that all the time. You said earlier that you always write for an audience, and that hit me because I always feel when I'm reading your stuff that you're writing for me. It feels really personal. And what? Pardon me? Okay. And I was just wondering, what do you imagine when you're writing to the audience? Who is it? What is it? Is it a person?
It's nobody I visualize. It's a definite person. I mean, it's a definite person, but I don't visualize that person. It's the reader. The reader is, I guess, I can only think like the audience is to an actor. You know, it's the person you're doing it for.
Thank you.
It's the occupying of the public space.
Yes.
Is there anyone on that side? Anyone on that side? You guys are that shy? Oh, we got one.
Hi. When I was in line outside, I was standing with two other writers, and one of them has been writing for less time than I have, and another writing for more. The one who's been writing for less time said, when she writes, she feels like a fraud. I asked the one who's been writing for longer, did you ever stop feeling like that? And she said, no. Then the person who's been writing for less time asked me, what is it about Joan Didion's writing? And I said, she writes with authority. Where do you get that authority?
Where do you get the authority? You gradually, you get it. You get it from the reader. The reader gives you the authority. It's that feedback, but you don't get it right away, and I always fear that you can lose it unless you're really careful with it.
Do you ever feel like a fraud still?
I don't feel like a fraud, but I feel like somebody who hasn't done as much work as she should. You know.
I think we all feel that way sometimes.
Yeah.
Over there.
Hi. I have a Bouvier de Flanders named Jingo.
Oh, they are angel dogs.
Aren't they? And when you mentioned that, it was just, I thought, what a rare woman to own this dog. And I was wondering what his or her name
was. He had a fancy name given him by his reader, but... But he was called Casey.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, I have one. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. I'd forgotten. I have one question that was submitted on Facebook, which is, what is your favorite place in Los Angeles and why?
Well, I think it has to be my new favorite place in Los Angeles. I mean, there are a lot of places I love in Los Angeles. I mean, when I first moved to New York, I came back to Los Angeles for the California primary, and I remember weeping as I went down. I went to a rally in South Central from LAX, and I remember weeping all the way to LAX, I mean, from LAX to South Central on my way to this rally. Political rally, and I could only think I was weeping because it was so beautiful. Well, South Central LAX to South Central is not one of the scenic drives of Los Angeles, but it was beautiful that night.
We have, I guess, time for one of each.
Okay,
okay, so this gentleman over here.
Hello, Joan. Thank you. One word jumped out when you described the first moment that you saw Quintana, her fierce, dark hair, and that word resonated as I read through the whole book. And listening to you talk tonight, I think of all the gifts that you've given us over the years, the fierce self-reflection is what I'm holding in my heart right now. How did you learn to be so fiercely self-reflective?
I don't know. It was just I think some people simply criticize themselves more than other people. I had that tendency.
Last question.
Yes, on the book cover of The Year of Magical Thinking, the John was in a different color.
Yeah.
But on Blue Nights, it says no, and I hope I have it right. But what does no mean?
It doesn't mean anything. The designer had originally put, the same designer did the cover, and I don't know what she had in mind, but she didn't tell me that she had anything in mind. So I can only think it didn't mean anything.
I was hoping it meant that no, Quintana didn't die.
No, I didn't mean that. I wish it did too.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to take one more last question right over here.
I was just wondering what type of advice you would have for younger writers or ones just starting out.
That would take me it would take me a week and a half to even begin to answer what I would teach younger writers. You know what I would tell them? I would tell them, rewrite. Okay. Don't be afraid to rewrite.
I think those are good words to close on. So rewrite. Thank you, Joan Didion.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.